Now, that's what public transport can be like, but increasingly around the world, it's not. And this is a bit more serious than our usual halftime topics, but increasingly, transit authorities in the world are proclaiming the safety of public transport while various sets of figures emerge, suggesting a worrying trend in the opposite direction. And before I give you those sets of figures, how much do you use the trains and the buses? You want to talk about this. I know, you mentioned it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I am a regular and grateful user of what little train service we do have to Pukekohe.
All right.
Near daily.
Okay, Tainui?
When I read about this subject for today, my mind instantly went back to a time when I was living in Sydney in the late 70s when my girlfriend and I were on a train once. And I can still see her face and the tears in her eyes, as much as I can still remember the face of the man who was leering at her and smiling at me. There was a real crush on the train, and I didn't know until afterwards that he was having her way with her, but she was just so freaked out and afraid and unable to say or do anything. It's a real dilemma. I think as a species we're kind of oddly sexualized in a way, and there's some real, you know, dodgy people out there, and I think this is something that we really need to be heedful of.
That was a horrible moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, of course, it's being urged on us as our desired future for good reasons. So we've got a lot of skin in the game. And out of Canada this morning, transit rife with sexual predators as women subjected to daily abuse on buses and subways. And the figures from around the place, not just Canada, but in Vancouver, transit police launched a public crackdown on sexual offences after a 23% spike in complaints year on year. An English poll by the Reuters Foundation, 32% of women in London say they are verbally harassed, one in five a victim of direct physical abuse. In Paris, 85% of women polled expressed little confidence in receiving help by a member of the public if they were in trouble. In some Latin American capitals, up to 6 in every 10 women report being physically assaulted on buses and trains. So we can, and it's, of course, it's a lot better here. But we also follow overseas trends in most respects eventually, don't we? So this is the public transport future at risk, isn't it, if women don't climb on board for very good reasons?
It would be the wrong reason for not having public transport enhanced. I mean, you could make the observation that in this country, that given that these kind of assaults generally tend to happen in crowded trains, it'll never happen in Auckland. That's not really the point. You cannot spend all your time concerned about, because there's a few idiots, a few nasty, shabby individuals who exhibit atrocious behaviour, that means that we are not going to do that which would be of enormous benefit to the citizenry as a whole. You make sure that you stamp out the behaviour, not going out of your way to avoid providing the services on which they exploit.
And this is the dilemma I had at the time, because if my girlfriend had told me what was happening, I would have gone off my nut. And, you know, and she would have been afraid of what kind of violence may have ensued. I think people have to speak out and rely on the goodwill of other commuters to come to their aid.
Well, it's a very common problem in Tokyo. I used to see it when I was living there back in the 90s. It was very common to see signs in many of the larger commuter stations saying "Chikan ni chui," which translates basically to "beware of perverts." And it was known that a certain subspecies of really shabby bloke would take advantage of the crush that was going on to enjoy themselves highly inappropriately. And one measure that was taken there was to provide women only carriages, which basically just admits, yeah, this is a problem. We can't solve it, so we're just going to have to work around it. One friend of mine did find herself being groped, and she simply reached down, grabbed hold of the wrist that the hand was connected to, lifted it up, and said, "Whose is this hand that was on my backside?"
Yep.
And the bloke was absolutely mortified and slunk off at the first available station. I think the Japanese, being the passive people that they are, probably he wasn't going to get the hiding that he might get in this country. But yeah, people do need to not passively tolerate it. Although I do sympathise with your girlfriend, Tiny, I can imagine she was absolutely traumatised. It can't be pleasant.
Yes.
If it were only the odd, very shabby bloke, it'd be all right. But of course, these stats suggest a trend that's a bit more than that. And there's a big feature on this in the New Statesman. And their remedies include request stops schemes, which allow women to get off closer to their destinations at night, and also better lit bus stops. But no one's come up with a comprehensive plan. And just apropos of that, just quickly, did you find it strange, or did you think it's a good idea that Auckland Council's planning to get rid of lights in Ponsonby's Western Park, they're already not replacing the bulbs. And the theory is that a dark park will discourage people from using it and therefore make it safer.
It will make it safer. It makes it a lot more dangerous and also puts the blame on any potential victims. Yes. If you walk through that park and find yourself assaulted, everyone will just say, well, what did you expect? It's a dark place. Blame the victim.
Well, if you're going to pay more rates, you expect lights and deserve them.
That's right. Bulbs are expensive. On the panel today, Steve McCabe with Tainui Stevens. What would they like to talk about? Steve?
I would like to talk about money, and in particular money for schools. The school I teach at in South Auckland is a decile 2 school. We do the best with what we've got. We don't have enormous resources. We've recently been recensused into a decile 1 school. In fact, we're a decile 1B school. I don't know if everyone's aware of this. There are, in fact, sub-rankings within school deciles. And certainly the lower rankings were divided into 3 sub-deciles. So we are basically number 29 on a 30-rung ladder of deprivation and poverty. So we're struggling. We are going to get approximately another $180,000 in funding as a result of that. But we're also going to lose other funding in other departments consequent to that. So we're not going to see an enormous benefit from this. We are still struggling enormously. We then saw in the, I think it was the Sunday Star Times last weekend, a big kerfuffle about the fact that Auckland Grammar's dropped a decile and so it'll get extra funding, and how bizarre that is. It leaves me almost speechless when I look at the fact that Auckland Grammar, they request a donation from their students of $1,000 per head per year. They are able to ask for an additional $250,000 in funding and just get it from their community. When I go through East Auckland, I go to places like Botany Downs, I see the Panasonic, I think it's Botany Downs, I'm not quite sure, the school opposite the shopping mall, auditorium, sponsored by, I believe, Panasonic. These are schools who've got enormous amounts of resources and funding. Schools like mine are struggling. We cannot be simply told, here's your resources, do your best with it. We are massively underfunded. We are massively under-resourced. As a result. We are understaffed. We are not able to provide for the kids that we are trying to teach. We are not equipped to provide everything they need, and yet the ministry at the moment is trying to shove through a $110 million per year program for flinging money at certain teachers to go off and be lead teachers in certain communities. We need a massive overhaul of education funding in this country. Hekia Parata's saying that the decile funding system at the moment is a blunt instrument that doesn't work well.
Yeah.
She's been the minister for 3 years. She needs to fix it if she thinks it's broken. Right now it is broken and it's her fault.
So what would the remedy be? I mean, unless you're Baird's Main Freight, you know, which has been a real success story out in South Auckland, unless you do find that kind of sponsor that you referred to, no matter how you, whether you have decile ratings or not, you've got to target need. So yeah. How would you go about it?
I would use Hekia's blunt instrument of decile funding and expand it considerably. The funding that we get at the moment is woefully inadequate for the needs that we have. I would considerably increase the decile weighting for the lower deciles. I would also go in the exact opposite direction of performance pay. There's a suggestion that the higher performing schools should be rewarded with additional funding. I think that's completely the wrong way around. Schools are underperforming. It's not because we're not bothering. It's not because we're not trying hard enough. It's because we are up against enormous challenges. So don't reduce our funding relative to other schools because we're not achieving as high as they are. See what we need. Ask us what it's going to take for us to be able to reach the kids that currently we are striving to reach and we can't.
Okay, you're actually describing, aren't you, a downward spiral which is denied regarding the decile system. You are saying because you're rated decile 1B, it heaps all the other problems on you.
Of course it does. I mean, the other obvious problem is that as decile ratings fall, parents will try and move away from that area if they can, because they don't want to send their kids to a decile 3 or a decile 2 school, which then increasingly leads us to just have a decile 1 school. And it's not just poverty that leads kids to be rubbish at school. It's the socio aspect of the socio-economic decile phrase. So many parents that I've taught, and I've mentioned this before on this very show, so many parents that I teach aren't engaged sufficiently with their kids. They don't care enough about their kids' education. It's all down to me and my colleagues to make sure that they get the educational opportunities provided to them and sold to them. We need to encourage these kids to take advantage of what they're offering. They're not getting reinforced at home. We need to have something extraordinarily attractive that we can sell to them, and we're not getting the support that we need from our minister.
You're describing a very big problem, though.
Oh, it's an enormous problem. It's an enormous problem. And I have got some of the answers. I don't claim to have all of them, but I think that what I'm suggesting will go a hell of a long way to starting to address the problem.
Steve McCabe on the panel. Tainui Stevens on the panel. What's on your mind, Tainui?
Well, I've got a bit of a brick to hurl as well, Jim. I'm thinking at the moment of the recent decision by Television New Zealand to divest itself of its Māori programs department. In an earlier part of my life, I think for the first 17 years or so of my work in this industry, I was on contract to Television New Zealand and have much cause to be grateful for what it taught me at the time. I still have good friends working there. And it really saddened me to see that they were going to be so short-sighted as to excise this Māori part of their being. I remember the end of the 80s going to the site where the building at TVNZ is now with a small bunch of us, Honeka, Ngāwini Shortland and a few others, to have karakia for this building that was to be built. And I thought to myself at the time, would this count? Not long after we established the Māori Programs Department, and Ernie Leonard, who was the boss, he passed away in the mid-90s, and we had his body lying in state in our marae that had been consecrated within TVNZ, and I thought to myself, would this count? And over the years, I've seen a gradual degradation, I guess, of programming across the board. I've seen Māori programming used to be a means to garner income for the channel. I've seen it carry on with a dodgy kind of commercial strategy to deliver its audiences to viewers. And along the way, you know, I just, when this news came out, I thought to myself, you know, how depressingly Pākehā. I can't think of any worse, not so much worse thing to say, but it just kind of upset me that they denied the truth of our country. It doesn't take much to look around to see that we have bicultural roots, and to leave just Te Karere within the institution puts a hell of a load on Te Karere. But it says a lot to me about the strategy that TVNZ have employed. Now, for me, I mean, there are programs there that people like, there are programs that people don't like. I think the company has taken advantage of people's laziness. Not that they're lazy, it's just that they're tired. They're tired after the act of survival. Middle class, working class, they sit in front of their TV, and as Wasi Shortland said at a hui a while ago, you feed people peanuts, you'll get monkeys. And for me, the nadir, if you like, of television strategy is a particular program called Embarrassing Bodies, which I think is just the most hideous thing I've personally seen, where people, you know, you're watching someone separating genitalia in high def while you're trying to munch on an ice cream sandwich. And these people are, you know, they go there with hope to fix their affliction in their psyche, and all I can see is that embarrassment and shame in their eyes. Are we not entertained? It really worries me that this, you know, this institution, so-called, this storyteller where we tell ourselves about ourselves ostensibly is going down a path, and at the other end of that path is Fox TV. So really, I accuse Television New Zealand of diminishing my mana as a citizen and as a consumer. I accuse Television New Zealand of prejudice and paternalism in equal measure. I also accuse them of being our country's most embarrassing body part. And it kind of reminds me of Dorothy tripping down the yellow brick road, and like her mates, they have no brain, they have no heart, and they have no courage. And so for me, TVNZ is less the institution people thought it ever was. I think it was just a learning curve. They disgust me.
They say they're essentially outsourcing now, don't they?
Yes, but they're still keeping the money. They're still keeping the money that will flow from the Māori funding agencies who will expect the production houses to use their facilities. I mean, there have been times when TVNZ have taken on board the kaupapa Māori, if you like. I was interested to hear Stephen Staland, a dear friend of mine, who is a producer of Tangata Pacifica, say on the news when the news came out. And after all, they've just, after the Shane Taudi moustache, they just advertised for a new head of the department, which went to Raewyn Rash, and I think she probably found herself in a hideous position of having to close things down. Stephen said that he thought we were the jewel in the crown. That was a metaphor that first came out in the era of Mounter. And at the time, I thought to myself, yes, it sounds very paternalistic. There's a big mortgage on that crown, and we're making the payments through our various Māori agencies. TVNZ haven't done much for Māori television over recent years, I'm afraid. They've denied the role, the important role that the Māori view has in the mainstream. So, you know, I just don't have confidence in them, and it pains me to see things like this happen. It Tainu shouldn't
Stevens.
Be like this.
Right, kia ora, Tainu Stevens on the panel with Steve McCabe. At my ceremony in Dunedin, I was given a hebe in a pot, says Chris Hibbert. It is flourishing, as am I, in paradise, in spite of the politics and increasing PC-ness. So let's do the increasing PC-ness before we talk about Roger Sutton again. Here's one more for you, Steve, just quickly. Continuing the discussion about why there are only 18% of men teaching in primary schools, and there are myriad reasons for the absence of men in schools, says Bob Culver. Men's, it's quite a long email, but here's the germane bit. Men's sense of humour is much appreciated by many boys, but now every word is analysed, maybe even recorded, however wry. Men are prone to frank, off-the-cuff, possibly exaggerated tongue-in-cheek statements. Boys love it, but such are now laced with hazard, having to choose every word like a lawyer or entomb it in PC waffle takes away the spontaneity which boys enjoy. Little wonder men walk away and leave it to the women. Bob Culver. So you can see where we're going with the general discussion, which will shortly include Roger Sutton again. But the extent to which you agree with Bob about the climate in schools?
There is... There's two sides to this. I mean, there's a story in the paper this morning of in this particular case, a female teacher who has been accused of all manner of inappropriatenesses at, I believe, a Catholic school. So there is obviously a climate within which people have been misbehaving extremely badly. But then that puts most teachers basically on high alert. We do watch what we say. I am very careful not to be in the same room as a teenage female pupil alone. I know I'm not going to do anything wrong, but I don't want the possibility of being accused of having done anything wrong to hang over my head. We cover ourselves constantly. And if it's bad working with teenagers, it's even worse working with small children. Men with working with small children are always going to have an eyebrow raised. And why exactly are you working with small children, sir? And the male teachers that I know personally who work in primaries are some of the most honest and decent people I know. But there is, in society, this perception that there's clearly something a tiny bit dodgy, isn't there?
Yes, I had a wonderful experience with reggae bands. One of the guys who brought his band up to perform had a long life in reggae, and his next chapter in his life was to become a primary school teacher. And like some of the people you mentioned, Steve, I was just kind of so thrilled that the guy with this kind of life experience and bountiful aroha was prepared to train to be a primary school teacher.
He's going to be an amazing role model for those kids. He's got a gift to offer them,
Absolutely.
And that's fantastic. But again, there will be people looking and going, so why exactly? And that's just not fair to him.
All right, let's get to Roger Sutton, because Catherine Dalzell will join us on this shortly. He's taking a bit of time off. He's horrified by allegations. He made a suggestive comment about the Prime Minister's wife, which has been roundly denied. Andrew Little is saying he shouldn't be given a golden handshake when he goes. And the drip feed continues of what he was like as a boss, what he may have said, that his mea culpa revelations may have been selective. There's also the question of G-strings, and this came out today, the suggestion to female staff that they participate in a G-string Friday. I think the State Services Commissioner has made this point. There's a difference between, context being key, between instituting a sober conversation, initiating a sober conversation, or reacting to something said at Friday night drinks. You would want to know context, wouldn't you?
You would to a degree, but I struggle to find out an appropriate context for the boss of an organisation saying to young female staff that they participate in a visible G-string Friday. That's tacky. That's beneath the dignity of somebody running a company like that. And I think context is important. I think the context that's relevant is the person himself. His behaviour, his individual remarks are within the larger context of his behaviour, his conduct and his attitude toward his staff. And some people can get away with, as it says, addressing people in potentially what's perceived as sexist terms. They can get away with physical contact as they speak, because for certain people that is a very honest and very genuine way of interacting. And with those people, like my cousin Andrew is Irish. I was over in Sydney with him a few months ago, and he has an effortless charm that the Irish have, and if I said the same things to a woman that he said, people would just think I was being creepy because I'm English. He can get away with it because he has nothing but innocence in him, and he presents himself in a very innocent way. If I did it, I don't have that charm that he's got. I just would come across as creepy, so I don't do it.
All right, so you're describing not just context, but all sorts of complicatedness.
All manner of complications. And so these words like honey and sweetie, they reflect a deeper underlying. Clearly, there's the fact that people are objecting to him saying this means that there's something a bit shabby about it.
Supposedly saying, we should say. Now, before we get to Catherine, Tainui, your quick comments.
Well, I think that any leader worth their salt should be aware of the comments that they make. Relating to, I don't know, intergender or sexual things and banter, I think they should just be very, very aware. And if you're not and you say that kind of stuff, even if you are the jolly, ebullient, cheeky kind of personality, if you're not aware, you have a lack of empathy that disqualifies you as a leader.
But that's going back to Bob's email about teaching, isn't it? The extent to which this awareness is a good thing and the extent to which it has made people too careful.
I don't know. It's interesting in the production that I've just been working on. We openly use language, you know, darling, I love you. And we do. We just have a whānau feel. And that's not sexualized at all. There's so many shoulder bumps and hugs. Gosh.
And so, as I say, that when you're addressing people in those terms, you do it within a context of mutual respect and affection.
Yes.
It's not done in a creepy, slimy kind of way. And so no one's going to be offended when you do it. Mm. But clearly people are taking offense when Sutton does it. Clearly there was something else underpinning that.
Mm. Well, Catherine Dalzell is an employment law specialist, and Catherine's a partner at Taylor Shaw and lectures at the University of Canterbury, and she's kindly joining us. Good afternoon, Catherine.
Good afternoon.
Now, first of all, the business of him making limited disclosure, revealing details of the complaints, which seemed, compared with more recent information, comparatively trivial. How seriously will that be regarded by Ian Rennie, do you think?
I think Ian Rennie has made it clear how seriously he sees it by publicly stating that was a breach of confidentiality. And I think that Ian Rennie found himself in an interesting situation on Monday where he came along to manage his Head of State Services Commission, the resignation of the CEO of a significant organisation, particularly for Christchurch, and found that, from what he's saying, confidential information being disclosed that should not have been disclosed. Now, there also appears that the full detail of what actually occurred and the nature of the complaint wasn't within that disclosure. And the consequence of that, if that has been a breach of confidence, then the consequence is that the public vilification of the complainant could create a whole new complaint of breach of confidence, and the complainant may be entitled to damages as a result of that. So I would imagine Ian Rennie's taking this very seriously.
Okay, that's interesting. Mm. Roger Sutton says, I deeply regret I didn't find out about these allegations earlier, with the implication that he had no idea of the bad feeling that may have existed. So to what extent does it behove you as the aggrieved party to confront the perpetrator and say, this isn't on for me, I don't want this?
The complainant is under no obligation whatsoever to communicate that directly, because the minute you put that obligation onto a complainant, then they've got a matter of proof as proving whether or not they took steps to oppose or to communicate that they didn't find it acceptable. Somebody in Roger Sutton's position, I love what your panellists are saying, someone in Roger Sutton's position has to be aware that if they engage in behaviour like this, then it can be interpreted wrongly, and they cannot expect that the staff member involved has to alert them to it.
Okay, but not everyone agrees with that point of view, and this is obviously, if you read all the online chat, and this has divided society to an extent because it's become a discussion about the way blokes behave. Should it be that discussion? Can blokes still be blokey in the modern workplace, Catherine?
My concern about the behaviour that we've... Well, first of all, what we've had is a discussion online about the behaviour according to the way Roger Sutton has described it. And that's the difficulty that we're all in, is that we're discussing that and we aren't privy to the full details of the complaint or the exact detail of the findings of the investigation. I can only go on what Ian Rennie has said. They found serious misconduct. So all of these discussions online and attacks on the complainant, and she's oversensitive, in my view, is simply unfair based on what has been said by Roger Sutton. And we're left in a situation where the more New Zealanders keep on vilifying this complainant, the more likely she will be entitled to compensation and damages for a breach of confidence and for her effective gag and not being able to respond.
I wonder if he'd said nothing, if the drip feed would have been prompted or not. That would be the interesting question.
We just don't know. We just don't know, do we? Yeah.
Catherine, thank you. Catherine, sorry, you wanted to say something else.
Oh, yeah. The other thing that I'm just concerned about in the media is that there's been a finding of serious misconduct, but a lot of people are also saying, there's been no consequence. He wasn't going to be dismissed. Therefore, it can't have been serious misconduct. That's a false analysis. There has been a finding of serious misconduct. There is a separate investigation as to the consequence of that. And so other things would have been taken into account, including Roger Sutton's contribution and all those sorts of things. So to link the consequence of the serious misconduct to the actual findings around it, in my view, has been very unfair for the complainant.
All right, thank you. Catherine Dalzell on the panel. Just got time for this, and it's interesting because if this goes ahead in Christchurch, you might think it would sooner or later apply to the rest of New Zealand. Auckland Council this year had to pull back on banning the scattering of loved ones' ashes and making people with urns of ashes consult with Wahitapu Māori Committee, Māori Committees overseeing sacred areas, and pay fees. That was a big schmozzle. Now in Christchurch, a draft bylaw that would allow ashes to be scattered in parks and reserves or buried in public gardens may be changed after objections from local iwi. The Runanga within Christchurch City have told the council scattering ashes in public places will alienate Ngāi Tahu from those public places, and Ngāi Tahu whānau would be indefinitely constrained from eating, laughing, running or playing. What we have here, Tainui, I know we've got almost no time, but we've got a clash of cultures here, don't we?
I think we do, but I think in the discovery of the solutions, we'll come to a fusion that will work for us. So many people want to have themselves just scattered, you know, in various places. My Pākehā grandmother died in Waihee. She was a big fan of Joseph Stalin. She would live through the Depression. She saw the mine as a beautiful thing that brought work, and she wanted us to spread her over the mine. So we did one night. I think we can come to some kind of solution, because I agree that for Māori to know that this particular area is one where ashes are, it's a bit tricky. But if there was an area that was sectioned off or an area of coast or whatever, I think we can come to a solution that would speak to who we are as a nation.
The Auckland solution, okay, the Auckland solution of signs in sensitive areas might be better than a bylaw.
Oh, I think so. The less laws, the better.
That's the compromise, sort of compromise you're talking about.
But as long as we know.
As long as you know. Tainui Stevens, thank you very much on the panel today. Steve McCabe, you too.
Thank you.
Thanks for your company, everybody, and checkpoints on the way.